Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service, or if you're listening on the web 989fm.com.au or on our podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. Great to have your company on this Monday morning, and I trust everyone had a beautiful weekend, hopefully a great Happy Mother's Day yesterday, wherever you chose to celebrate it. I hope you had a really great day. Today we're going to be talking to a young journalist who had quite a eventful weekend down at the Newcastle Action, blocking one of the world's largest coal export facilities. And we'll be talking to him very shortly, Tom Mitchell, a journalist for New Matilda. But first of all, I wanted to preface this discussion with a very interesting story that is going to be aired on Four Corners tonight. So I'll go to the trailer and then I'll tell you a little bit about it. But I really hope that a lot of our listeners can tune into it, because it has a lot of the themes that we talk about constantly on Let's Talk. So I'll just run the trailer.
A body on the beach.
She was a person, a human being.
A trail of evidence.
They're worse than a pack of animals.
Where is the justice?
I can't understand it. From my reading, it's a very clear case of manslaughter.
Caro Meldrum Hannah reports.
What would happen if it was your daughter?
Four Corners, Monday.
So that's Four Corners tonight. So I think it's screening at 8:30. And it's actually looking into the case of a young Aboriginal woman, 33-year-old Aboriginal woman, Lynette Daly, who was found dead on Ten Mile Beach down in northern New South Wales in January 2011. And it was a really horrendous case where she'd obviously died from really quite horrendous injuries. And there's two men who were actually charged over her death at the time. One of them was her former boyfriend and his friend. And despite them never being charged, despite them both being charged, the DPP down in New South Wales never prosecuted the cases, which just seems amazing. I mean, why wouldn't you prosecute these cases? So tonight on Four Corners, they're actually going to investigate the case, but particularly they're looking at the fact that this was a young Aboriginal woman. Had race played a factor? And there's some really interesting comments from Talia Anthony, who's an associate professor down at the University of Technology, Sydney, a criminologist down there with a large history in Aboriginal justice issues. And she says she can't really understand it. She's seen other cases with other victims with less evidence, and there's been prosecutions. And she says it's not a coincidence that she's an Aboriginal woman. They are overrepresented as victims and yet do not receive the same type of support by police and by the justice system when they are victimised. And I think it's because we as a society don't treat Aboriginal women with the same dignity and humanity as we treat non-Aboriginal women or men. So I'll definitely be watching Four Corners tonight, particularly because later in the week we're going to be running a series of specials on the Barrowville murders, which were three Aboriginal children: Colleen Walker, who was 16, Evelyn Greenup, who was 4, and Clinton Speedy Duro, who was also 16. They died on the same stretch of street in Barrowville Mission from 1990 to 1991, and the only man ever accused of their murders has never been convicted, or they're trying to get him back into court, and there's a whole host of complicated legal reasons that are stopping that. But it comes down to a lot of these issues around how police and the courts treat Aboriginal victims. So I really hope that you guys can tune into that very important report on Four Corners tonight. Now, we're going to switch topic a little bit now, and it's actually another topic that we've had a strong focus on in the past week, talking to a lot of the young Aboriginal warriors working for SEED, and it's around climate change. And particularly we're talking to Tom Mitchell, who's a journalist specialising in environmental issues for New Matilda, and he's joining me on the phone from, I think it is, Sydney. How are you today, Tom?
Oh, I'm a little bit tired after the weekend's activities, but otherwise I'm good.
Excellent. Can you tell us a little bit about those activities? What did what happened down in Newcastle?
Okay, so it was a blockade of Newcastle coal, which is the largest coal in the world. And there were a series of sort of different actions that went on during the day. So the main event, I suppose, was on Horseshoe Beach in Newcastle, where it was sort of very festive. You know, about 200 kayaks went into Newcastle Harbour and blocked off the channel so that coal ships didn't come in and out of the channel. And then, you know, there were a lot of families at the beach and people from the Pacific doing dances and from down there doing some dances and talking about country and that sort of thing. And then there was another action where people blocked a rail line, and those people were all arrested. And then there was another action earlier in the morning, which a number of people sort of scaled at the anchor of a big ship and did a banner drop. So there was those three, but people had been camping out at a scout camp not far from Newcastle on arriving on Friday, and then there was a lot of sort of legal briefings and training and stuff on the Saturday. And then on the Sunday, as I said, there were those three different actions. There was probably 1,500 people on the beach.
That's a lot of people.
And yeah, it was. It was, and it was interesting to have that sort of very family-friendly focus on the beach, but also those harder actions going on off to the side. Yeah.
We might just go to a break because I think we're having a bit of trouble hearing you, but we will be back shortly. We'll go to a song by Kayleen Brambrick, and we've got Tom Mitchell on the line. We're just trying to get better hearing, better try and hear him a little bit better. So we'll be back shortly after the break. Good morning. Welcome back to Let's Talk, where we're on the line with Tom Mitchell down in Sydney, who over the weekend attended the series of blockades and protests down in Newcastle at a large coal export facility. And he was just telling me a little bit before the break about the fact there was about 1,500 people there and about a 70 who took part in, I guess, an arrestable action. Can you tell me a little bit about those actions, Tom? What was the reason behind the protest at this specific spot?
Well, as I said before, I'm not sure if people caught it because the reception was cutting out, but Newcastle, so a lot of the fossil fuels that Australia pumps out into the global marketplace go through Newcastle Coalport, and I guess what protesters were trying to draw attention to is, well, part of what they were trying to draw attention to is that a lot of Australia's contribution to climate change actually happens through fossil fuel exports. And we make a relatively small contribution to global warming, although it's high per capita. Overall, the Australian contribution to global warming is, you know, around 1.5%, I think.
Which is huge, isn't it?
But the coal exports, well, the contribution, it's huge in as much as Australians have some of the highest per capita emissions, but it's not huge in the sense of, you know, someone like China or the US, which make up a huge proportion of it. But we do sell those people a lot of the fossil fuels that they burn. And, you know, I'm sure your listeners would know that our governments are constantly trying to expand those markets. So it was drawing attention to that and calling for an end to new coal mines and increases in exports.
That's very interesting. It's a very interesting point to pick up because it's very much lost in the debates around fossil fuels and our emissions, the fact how much we actually export. And you were saying something about the fact it could reach about 1 billion tonnes of carbon emissions in the coming years.
Yeah, well, this year Greenpeace put out a report recently and it was all based on government data. And they said that our carbon emissions would be about 560 million tonnes domestically, but that in just the coal we export, when you burn that coal overseas, that amounts to 1 billion tonnes of carbon.
Yeah.
And we're soon to be the largest exporter of LNG, which is a whole other, you know, fossil fuel export.
Why is the case that internationally, I guess, it is the country that burns the fossil fuels that's, I guess, responsible? I mean, is that something that's being changed in negotiations, or is there a focus on that internationally?
No, look, I don't think it is going to change. I think, and a lot of people think that that is one of the big weaknesses of the sort of international response to climate change. because there's an incentive for governments to go ahead and export as much fossil fuels as they can, because there's no accounting of that.
Yeah.
But that's just the way that the framework has been set up, and it's kind of, it would be very difficult to change it now. You know, I was in Paris last year, and you can imagine that the bureaucracy around those UN targets and things are really difficult to change, and it's all codified in conventions and stuff. So that's just the way that it is. But, you know, the fact that the UN doesn't count it doesn't negate the fact that Australia is actively trying to create markets for fossil fuels, which are destroying the planet.
Now, there's actually an action going against this practice right now in our own backyard. We're up in Queensland, and it has to do with the controversial Adani mine, doesn't it? The Australian Conservation Foundation is actually challenging the Environmental Minister Greg Hunt over the approval of that mine. Can you, and you've covered this case. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so ACF is a case represented by the EDO, the Environmental Defenders Office, and basically what they argue is that when Greg Hunt approved the Adani mine for the second time around, he didn't consider the impact that the emissions would have when they're burnt in other countries. So whoever buys the coal from the Adani mine is obviously going to burn it. That will create greenhouse gas emissions. And the argument that ACF is making is actually around the World Heritage status of the Great Barrier Reef. And so Greg Hunt, under international agreements, has obligations to protect the reef because it's World Heritage. And ACF is making the argument that, well, the UN framework might not count the fossil fuels you export, but the reality is that those greenhouse gas emissions are going to have the same impact on the Great Barrier Reef. Doesn't matter where they're burned. As soon as you start to burn them, then you threaten the Great Barrier Reef. And the greatest threat to the long-term survival of the Great Barrier Reef is climate change. So they're trying to make the argument that he should have countered the fact that they would obviously burn in a third-party country and that they would come back to bite the Great Barrier Reef, and that that is a harm that he should have seen, and that he shouldn't have approved the mine because it's just too much greenhouse gases and too many environmental impacts.
But what Greg Hunt, I guess, is arguing is that you can't draw any conclusions between that increase and Adani's potential emissions, isn't it? That's his argument that he's sort of putting in the federal court.
Yeah, it's sort of mixed up in this argument about, and it's come up in previous court cases with Adani, but basically the argument is that if we don't sell the fossil fuels, somebody else will do it anyway. And so it doesn't really make a difference whether or not we approve big new coal mines, and that gives rise to greenhouse gas emissions, because if we don't sell the coal, Indonesia or someone else will do that. I guess ACF is arguing that he has obligations. You know, he can't help what Indonesia do or don't do. But he has obligations to protect the Great Barrier Reef. And by approving that coal mine, you know, there's no doubt it will create the emissions, and there's no doubt that those emissions will harm the reef. And it's a really interesting case, actually, because it could set a precedent that would make it more difficult to get big fossil fuel projects approved, because normally the Environment Minister hasn't considered what kind of emissions are going to be created because of all those things that we were talking about before.
Yeah. And I guess it's also, I mean, he's found it quite easily to get around a lot of mechanisms to approve this mine. I mean, he's done it twice, hasn't he, just by passing legislation? Good.
Yeah. Well, the initial application, he made an approval a couple of years ago, and that was challenged because he didn't consider what they call a conservation advice. So it was actually quite a technical legal issue, and Greg Hunt or the Department of Environment conceded that they had got the approval wrong, but that didn't stop them giving it back again in 2 months' time. And basically it was that there's this advice prepared for the minister which looks at threatened species and what the impact on them would be, and he didn't see this technical form of advice for the ornamental snake, and there was a skink. I forget exactly the name of the skink, but these two little critters turned out to be a big sticking point. But as you say, I mean, within 2 months it had been reapproved. So I think this case would have wider ramifications if it gets up than that one
quite
did.
Significant. What do you feel? I know. I guess a lot of our listeners are quite outraged as well by the Adani mine, by this continual sort of dragging out Greg Hunt. I remember the latest case where it actually came out here to prove that mine. There was a lot of outrage, but I guess it sort of subsides over time. I mean, you were just down in Newcastle. You've sort of talked to a lot of activists. You've seen a lot of protests around the country. How do we keep this outrage alive, do you think? I mean, what's the most important things? Because it just seems like we're up against this big wall in relation to what governments want to do.
Yeah, and I think it is increasingly disconnected from communities, what governments want to do. But, you know, I think one of the things that has made the Adani campaign sort of fade back a bit is that no one wants to give that mine money. Mm. And there is a whole lot of environmental reasons why it shouldn't be approved, and social reasons around, you know, impacts on farmers and the use of water there and Aboriginal people's water and connected to their country, you know, these sort of issues of drying up springs and stuff that are really significant to the people up there. But I think that part of the reason that it's faded back a bit is a lot of people are sort of looking on and going, well, no one's going to finance it. They need something like $10 billion before they reach financial close.
Yeah.
And there's this big, long list of banks. I'd have to check the number, but, you know, it's 14 or 15 banks or something.
Yeah, the latest one was Commonwealth,
high.
I think, late last year, which is a high-profile one.
Yeah, and, I mean, it just took away a lot of the funding pool that normally bankrolls those sorts of projects. And that was, in large part, I think, a result of the campaign. You know, the 350.org, for example, put a lot of pressure on the Australian banks to say that they wouldn't approve it, that they wouldn't finance it, sorry. But also, it just isn't a great economic proposition. I mean, the coal price has tanked. A lot of people believe it's in structural decline, so the price won't bounce back. And I think, realistically, yes, banks listen to that sort of social campaigning, but, you know, I don't think that they're necessarily making their decisions based on what activists or the community want. I think that they're just looking at it and going, well, that's not a really great financial proposition, and it's not in their interest to bankroll it.
When we talk about economics particularly, though, governments seem willing to just push money into fossil fuel industries, even though, as you were saying, coal's on the decline, don't they? I think the latest figures are something like $7.7 billion they're giving to fossil fuel industries in the form of subsidies. So even when you look at that, I mean, what sort of justification does governments have for giving that amount of subsidy to these industries?
Look, it's a good question. I think a lot of people are asking themselves that question all the time. It doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, there is a huge amount of subsidies that go on, and there's this whole mythology around, you know, coal mining being a huge employer. It's not. It's about 2% of the workforce. Why are they doing it? I think something that Tony Abbott said last week was really interesting. He basically said that the mining industry should reward Ian McFarlane for his work in helping repeal the mining tax, which is a pretty startling thing to say, but it does show how cozy that relationship is. Mm. And there's this revolving door between politics and the mining industry. So in New South Wales, you know, we're at Newcastle over the weekend, the mining lobby is headed up by a guy called Stephen Galloway, who used to be the chief of staff to Mike Baird, who's premier in New South Wales.
Yeah.
So there's staffers who move around like that, but there's also politicians who just move into consulting. I mean, Mark Vaile, the former deputy prime minister, stepped straight out of that job and into a job in charge of Whitehaven Coal.
So
and
they
that's
all help
really
each other.
Common.
Yeah, they help their mates out, you know?
Yeah.
It's
yeah, it sounds a bit like a broken record, but it's true.
Yeah, it's very sad. Now, going back towards what we were talking about originally, and you just mentioned it around Newcastle, I mean, you said about 70 people had been arrested. When we talk about political, penalties, just recently the New South Wales government passed really horrendous anti-protest laws, particularly to stamp down on these sort of protests, didn't they? Can you tell us a little bit about those? First of all, those anti-protest laws, because I know you've written quite a lot about it.
Yeah. So they were laws which were openly designed to prevent people from engaging in the sort of protests that happened over the weekend. The government made no bones about the fact that that's what they were there for. They increased the fine, effectively the fine for trespass, tenfold. So it used to be a maximum penalty of $550. And they added an aggravated version of that offence, which took the fine up to $5,500.
Wow.
They expanded a provision around being able to be sent to jail, although I don't think that people are about to be sent to jail for protesting New South Wales, but they did expand.
It's up to about 7 years, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a maximum of 7 years, but as I say, it's not a new offence, and the main thing was that they expanded it to include coal seam gas,
right, yeah.
Which I think was probably more a scare tactic than anything. And that was sort of the main elements of the law. There's some preemptive aspects, so if police suspect that someone is about to, you know, use a device, they find a device and they think they're going to use it to lock themselves to machinery or something like that, there are some powers that have been given there. But the interesting thing is that the laws hadn't received assent before the protest yesterday, and so they weren't actually in effect.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah, which is an interesting play because it seems, you know, there was such desperation to get it through. The government kind of rushed them through, and it was the most important thing in the world. But from a PR perspective, I think that it would actually be quite smart of them not to have passed those laws because people want to test them. And I wrote a column at the time. I really think that the Baird government is going to regret those laws.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, they're not really a deterrent, are they? Because if anything, they help people get sort of more of the message out.
Yeah, and I think that people feel really angry, you know, when the reason that people have to take non-violent direct action protest in the first place is it's not because it's particularly fun. It's not because it's comfortable. People don't get anything out of it. And I think that that's often really lost in these discussions, is that it's a selfless act. They're not getting any sort of payoff for that. But they do it because they feel that the system, there is no other way to get that message across. And, you know, I spent a lot of time looking at planning systems, and you can tell a lot by the fact that the federal government just doesn't say no to coal mines. Yeah. I'm not sure that there's ever been a coal mine that's been rejected.
Yeah.
And if there has, you know, a very small number. But with that as the background, when you then have someone tell you that you can't do that either and change the rules again so that the system is again not allowing people to have a meaningful say in what's going on, then they're pretty determined people, and I think the reaction is going to be against that.
Yeah.
And it's going to sort of embolden them and confirm the reasons why they want to do it in the first place.
Taking that into mind, would you say yesterday was a successful protest action?
Yeah, I would. I mean, I can't see how it could have gone any better. The protesters say that they stopped the coal exports from Newcastle during that day. I mean, the people who operate the port, they had ample warning, so they didn't try and send a ship out or bring a ship in. So people did, in the kayak part of the action, did block the port, and they did stop them, you know, ships coming through for 10 or 12 hours or something. And then there was the rail line action where all those people, probably 65, 70 people, lined up along a rail bridge, which apparently is a sort of bottleneck. So all the trains that come into the largest coal port in the world at Newcastle kind of have to go over this bridge. And they blocked that off for most of the day as well and say that there was no coal trains going through. But as I say, you know, there was a huge amount of warning for the companies involved in these exports. So they would have easily planned around it. But there's a powerful symbolism, and I think that that's part of these actions is people register their dissent, and particularly those people who got arrested. There's something in that statement of saying, I'm willing to, you know, risk my own discomfort and my own suffering. I'll have to go back to Newcastle for court. So, yes, it stopped the port operating that day, I suppose, but it's also more about people laying down that ultimatum and saying, you know, I'm willing to put myself out and do this sort of protest action because it means that much to me. So I think it was successful, but, you know, I don't think that immediately will make a huge difference to fossil fuel exports, but you can never really expect that from those kind of actions.
I just wonder, because obviously yesterday I didn't see a lot of media around it, and I know that you were there, so you haven't been able to see the media cycle, but particularly up here, I guess it sort of gets, and I don't know about our listeners either, you might have seen a bit about it, people who are listening, but I guess because it was Mother's Day yesterday, but also the election was called. I mean, I didn't hear a lot about these protests. I guess as we're going into a federal election, do you expect these issues around fossil fuels, climate change to even be a factor as we go into the election cycle?
I do, but the problem is, you know, everything that Labor says over this coming election, people need to be aware that that's not fossil fuel exports. So we're talking before about how that's, in a lot of ways, that's really Australia's main contribution, is that we try and expand our fossil fuel exports whenever we can. Labor's not going to be talking about that. They're going to be talking about bringing down domestic emissions and different ways to do that. And that's a good thing. And, you know, they're way ahead of the coalition on that front. But I think one of the important things is that what people were trying to draw attention to over the weekend was really the export coming out of Newcastle.
Yeah.
And that's not something the major parties want to talk about. Richard Di Natale, the leader of the Greens, did give a press conference there yesterday. But how much that manages to cut through, I don't know. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But I think that unfortunately what we'll see is that there will be, that climate change will be made a central issue.
Yeah.
Labor's staked a lot on it over the last couple of weeks. And they're, you know, approaching that as a real point of difference with the government. But as I say, you know, it's a very limited scope, and it's what Labor wants to talk about, where we need to have a broader conversation, I think.
I guess it's the case always. It is in every sort of area of policy, of you're picking the least evil. I guess you're picking the devil you know, I guess. We sort of know a bit about what the coalition has done over the past few years. I just wonder if, I guess, they could get any worse than that. Labor could get any worse than that. I don't think we have two particularly good options at hand.
No, I would agree with that. But, yeah, it is heartening that Labor's brought it back to the table. And, I mean, there are good things and bad things about Labor's plan for climate action, but at least they have a plan. And I think that people who watch this space know that the coalition really doesn't have a plan.
Yeah.
We really don't know what they're going to do. And their targets are 26 to 28% lower emissions by 2030, based on 2005 levels. And Labor is going for a target of 45% by
right.
the same time. So there's a big difference in that alone. And I think that, you know, there are issues with Labor's plan, but you've got to pay them for the fact that they're, you know, nearly double as ambitious.
And I hope we can get you on during the election cycle, because I reckon it'll be really good to go behind and interrogate a lot of what both major parties are saying in relation to climate change. We might just go to a break now, but when I come back, I want to talk about the people who are already suffering horrendously from climate change and from Australia's complicity in what we're talking about global, in coal exports particularly. So we're here with Tom Mitchell, who's a journalist from New Matilda and a young journalist. I think he's only about 21 or something, but we'll get him to, I might have been saying the wrong thing there. But we'll be back soon. A bit of East Journey from a great Aboriginal band from Arnhem Land. We'll be back shortly.
If you missed today's show or would like to hear Let's Talk Again, catch the repeat from 7 p.m. weekdays or listen via the podcast at 989fm.com.au. Here's Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome back to Let's Talk, where our focus is on climate change with New Matilda's environmental reporter, Tom Mitchell, and he joins me on the line from down in Sydney. Now, over the weekend, he was actually in Newcastle covering and taking part in the protests down there of the coal export facility, and you obviously spoke to a lot of people down there, Tom. Particularly, I know there's been a lot of focus in the past actions on the Pacific Islands and the fact that they're very much on the front line. Did you speak to many people down there regarding that issue?
Yeah, look, the protests were sort of in some ways led by Aboriginal people and Pacific Islanders, which I think is, you know, a really important thing. But I spoke to, I've forgotten his last name, but I spoke to a fella called Zane, who's from Tonga, and he said, you know, that there's this tradition in that society of planting a tree to mark significant events. And they planted one when his grandfather died, and he said, you know, the idea is that no matter where in the world your family is or what's going on, that the, you know, the branches and everything will all sort of be connected. And he told this lovely story, but he said that now that tree that was planted not very long ago is 15 meters out to sea.
Oh,
because
my God.
It's already happening, right? So, I mean, that's a sort of poor paraphrase of the story, but it was this really lovely story about, you know, the culture in Tonga and how people see, you know, their family and their connection to land.
Yep.
And that idea that, you know, the tree will always have roots there.
Yep.
But the story just sort of showed that climate change is changing that. Mm. And we're seeing that across a whole bunch of different areas, but particularly in the Pacific now. But one of the things that was really amazing about that protest and really striking is this sense of community. And I was speaking to a woman, she was a 63-year-old woman from Canberra, sort of an unlikely suspect. You wouldn't necessarily expect her to be involved in protest action. But she said that when she saw the beautiful dancing that a mob of the Pacific Islanders who came along did there, that she started crying and she had tears in her eyes. And I guess it's just a nice way of sort of explaining that there's this sense of community building up around the climate movement. And these people, a lot of the people there knew each other, but there was also a lot of new faces.
Mm.
And I think there is a really sharp awareness in people who follow these issues that, you know, it's Pacific Islanders, it's Bangladeshis, it's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are going to be hit first.
Yeah.
And hardest, and the people who did the least to contribute to the problem, you know, are going to cop the most consequences. And I think that's what motivates people like the protesters at Newcastle, is this great sense of the injustice of what's going on and awareness that it's still continuing to go on. You know, emissions are still rising.
Yeah.
And that's where that sense of urgency comes from, that we have to do something. And that's why people feel that they need to take the sort of action that they were taking over the weekend.
And when you talk about the fact that Pacific Islanders and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, actually Indigenous peoples all around the world, are going to face this first. I mean, there are people in our own backyards, very close to us, our neighbours pretty much, who are already facing it. And you wrote a really good piece in April about a group of islands near Bougainville who are actually really suffering right now from the effects of climate change.
Yeah, so the story was about the Carteret Islands, and there's a couple of other islands as well, which from memory were Micronesian descent, so sort of different bloodline. But the story on the Carteret Islands was that they need to evacuate. They've known for quite a while that their islands are just not going to be viable to live on. And that process has started, but the only money they've really had is from various churches who have charitably donated some money. I think they've evacuated 110 people so far, and they've got, you know, more than 1,000 to go. But one of the things that really struck me about that was that because it's already happening, they're already losing a lot of land to the rising sea, but they're also losing their food gardens. Yeah. And their ability to live on that island. And the kids, they actually closed the schools, I think, in March, because there's just not enough nutritious food and the kids couldn't concentrate. And as I say, I mean, that's what drives the protests like we saw over the weekend, is an awareness that it's already happening and it's not something we need to deal with in the future. We needed to deal with it 15 years ago.
So we have a situation, and I think it's really interesting when you look at starvation in Pacific Islands, because you sort of think, oh, they're these beautiful paradise places filled with tropical fruits, everything like that. But there are obviously children who are starving so much they can't go to school over there, whereas food insecurity is such a big issue because of climate change that their education has suffered or they've just had to be evacuated. I mean, that's such a huge humanitarian issue, and it seems that it's not getting into people's heads just how urgent it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the interesting things about this, it should be said that I was told that they need $1.6 million to do the rest of their evacuation, which is such small beer for Australia, you know. But they haven't seen anything from us yet. But, you know, one of the issues is going to be migration. If we think we've got a problem now with what's going on in Europe and more ludicrously in Australia with people seeking asylum, climate change is going to displace huge numbers of people. And part of the problem is you can't be persecuted by the environment. So the laws around refugees and how you seek asylum, you know, you can seek asylum based on your discrimination, based on your ethnicity, sexuality, religion, you know, there's things like that. Yeah. But it doesn't recognize being persecuted by the environment. But that's this new category of asylum seeker that we're seeing emerge, is people like those people living on the Carterets who are being persecuted by the environment and who can't live on their ancestral homelands anymore. And we do need to start having a sort of proactive approach to looking at these issues, as well as obviously bringing down emissions to try and mitigate how many people that's going to happen to.
Late last year, you mentioned before you're at the Paris climate change talks, but you're one of the few journalists, I guess, in Australia who covered particularly, you know, the cries of Pacific Island leaders at those talks, particularly from Kiribati, who's very much under siege right now from rising sea levels. I mean, was there any reaction? I know he particularly pointed out Australia's complicity and the need for them to do something, but has there been any reaction from particularly, you know, those protests, I guess, from Pacific Island nations at the climate talks from Australia?
Australia's government, no.
Yeah.
I think both major parties are pretty comfortably saying that they're going to continue to export as much fossil fuels as possible. And that's one of the distinctions that the president of Kiribati, Anete Tong, made, is he said, you know, it doesn't matter to us who sells them. Whoever sells them is sinking our homeland, and it's as simple as that.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think there's been a political reaction, and we don't talk about the impact that our exports are having, which is our biggest driver of climate change that we contribute. Certainly, though, from the protest movement, those people are being heard. And, you know, it's not the first time there's been a Pacific contingent at the flotilla. There's been, I think, 8 flotillas in Newcastle Harbour doing similar things. This was definitely the biggest so far. But in 2014, there was this brilliant action where a bunch of people, called the Pacific Climate Warriors, and I might be paraphrasing here a bit, but their sort of catch cry is, you know, we're not drowning, we're fighting. And they're starting to build really strong relationships between Australian activists and people from the Pacific, because it is sort of the hallmark of Australia's shame, you know, the fact that we're not listening to people like Anete Tong, and we're paying lip service to their problems. But we saw last year, you know, that press conference where Peter Dutton was laughing.
Yeah,
he said, definitely. Oh, you know, what doesn't matter what time it is when you have water lapping at your doorstep or something.
Yeah,
and he didn't realize there was a boom mic. But I think that was pretty representative of how Australia's politicians are treating Pacific Islanders. You know, to them it's just a bit of a laugh. But as we were just talking about, to people in the Pacific, it's already
happening.
A crisis point in some places, yeah.
And I think it's really ironic as well, because I know we've spoken before about the fact when the outpouring of, I guess, Australian generosity in relation to Cyclone Pam over in Vanuatu, and it seemed to really touch a lot of Australians, and sort of the Australian government were sort of congratulated for their quick response in getting a lot of aid over there. But the fact is that we're still continuing our really horrendous policies in relation to coal, our love affair with coal. I mean, that's going to continue. We can't pat our backs on one hand and then continue to drive up, you know, these things that are ultimately going to cause climate change. There's a bit of irony in there, a bit of hypocrisy, I guess, isn't there?
Oh, rank hypocrisy. Absolutely rank. But, yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true. And one of the problems is going to be that the system at the moment seems to be, I mean, obviously we can expect more storms, more ferocious storms, and more people being affected by natural disasters like Cyclone Pam. I mean, Fiji's just had Winston and then Zena, you know, within 2 months of each other, two tropical cyclones. And we're going to see more of that. And The problem is that at the moment, the system is one based entirely around charity. And so if you have more and more disasters and more serious disasters, a system where, you know, Australia has to pat itself on the back and people just have to be generous is not going to work because there's this ongoing problem. And so I think we do need to acknowledge that and start to try and think about ways to set up systems that it's not going to rely on generosity, because that will run out. But the fact that Australia is exporting fossil fuels as much as possible, you're right, it absolutely flies in the face of any sort of concern that we're expressing about what's happening to those people.
What can the average listener, do? Because I know a lot of people might not be able to get down to a blockade down in Newcastle, but I guess for listeners who want to do something, what do you think are the first steps, or do you have any ideas of how people might be able to help?
Well, so there's sort of two levels. You know, you can change your light globes, you can use less water, you can stop eating red meat. There's all these things you can do personally. You can ride your bike instead of your car or whatever. But that only goes so far. Mm. And it's a systemic problem. You know, when we talk about having the transition away from fossil fuel, it's basically the Industrial Revolution Mark II. You know, it's the Industrial Revolution was that we moved on to fossil fuel power and that became the basis for our economy. Yeah. And now what we're talking about is we need to have another Industrial Revolution scale change to move to renewables or other clean forms of energy. And that's a systemic problem, and it's a deeply political problem. So I think if people want to have a meaningful impact, there are a lot of ways you can engage with the climate movement. But we were talking earlier, you know, about how the United Nations framework doesn't count exports, and there's all these sort of peculiarities around how it actually works. One of those things is that it's totally up to individual domestic governments what they do and when. There's nothing legally enforceable or binding internationally that says governments have to stick to a carbon budget or anything like that. And so it really depends on how that plays politically. So if there's enough of a movement from ordinary people pushing Australian governments to do more about climate change, then they will do more because it will be politically in their interest. And, you know, I think you and I both know that politicians do what's in their interest.
Yeah.
And it's not always an entirely moral decision. So I think people do need to start to engage in that movement, and that we saw a lot of that over the weekend, but you don't necessarily need to travel all the way to Newcastle to do that. There are groups all over the country. 350.org, which was one of the main drivers of this action over the weekend, is across the country, and especially, you know, definitely in the major cities. But I guess it's just looking out for grassroots groups that people can engage in and making those connections, because there are a lot of seasoned activists out there who know what they're doing and they've got a plan, and need more people to be involved in those plans. But it's just a matter of making those connections and having those conversations about what you can do, because, you know, to block a rail line, for example, you can do that anywhere. Mm. And people increasingly are. But I do think that it's got to be a people's movement, because it's a systemic issue.
Yeah.
And so I guess making those connections and asking people who are already active in that space what you can do is the best way to go about approaching that. And people generally find it quite empowering when they do start to do that. So
I have another idea too. You can follow Tom Mitchell at New Matilda and follow a lot of your writings, because you're one of, I guess, one of the few sort of environmental reporters out there on the front lines in a way, going and making things accessible to the general public, really complicated environmental legislation and laws. I know I'm very thankful for you to breaking that down. So thank you so much for joining us on the program today, and I hope that we can get you on during the election cycle. We might be able to do a bit of myth-busting, regardless of whatever the politicians say, whatever comes out of their mouth in relation to this. So thanks so much for your time today, Tom, and we'll keep us updated about what you're doing next.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Amy, and it'd be great to talk to you soon.
Thanks. That's Tom Mitchell, who's an environmental reporter for New Matilda, only a young fellow who went to the protests in Newcastle, and we have a strong focus on reporting on climate change on every aspect as Aboriginal peoples, because as Tom was saying, it ends up affecting Indigenous peoples first, not only our Pacific Island neighbours, but Aboriginal homelands all across the country, and particularly Torres Strait Islanders up the top end of Australia, who are, you know, particularly on Saibai and a lot of the outer islands, they're dealing right now with the effects of climate change and dealing with politicians who just don't want to listen. So that's all we have time for today. I'll see you tomorrow and tune in for Let's Talk.
This is Let's Talk with Amy McQuire.